Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
All right, here we go, everyone. Welcome to yet another fantastic matchless episode of Dead Rock Stars. Now today, Mick Wall, my dear friend, who's also here helping me, we are going to talk
about... Am I here helping you? Oh, that's good. Well, I'll tell you what, you fire away, I'll help
if
when
I
can.
If I need you, you'll say a few words, yeah? All right, good.
Possibly.
So, in my mind, the rock stars that we've covered in this series so far, which have been sort of hugest impact, have been Bowie and Freddie, I would say, when it comes to the rock star world. The only other person in my mind who matches those luminaries, who is no longer with us, is, of course, the great... Minneapolis resident Mick Wall.
Oh, sorry. Need some help?
That was all a massive build-up.
You need some help?
Yeah. Could you help me? What's the name of the dude?
Oh, hang on. Let me look on Wikipedia. Prince.
What was his full name?
You said I'd only be here to help, not actually. You know.
When you finish sweeping the floor.
Yeah.
Tell me who it is.
Yeah.
What was his actual name? His name was
Prince Rogers Nelson.
So his name was Prince Nelson. You know, when he wrote a check.
His father was Lord Nelson.
When he wrote a check,
he was Prince Nelson.
Or you know, did something. Filled out his address on the when they wanted to deliver some milk to Paisley Park.
When he was doing
P.
the,
Nelson.
When
is that
he was
literally
doing
his
the
name?
Football pools.
Right, P. Nelson. Is that how he's?
Yeah, signed? His name is actually Prince.
All right, good.
Like Madonna's
his
name
is Prince,
actually,
and he is funky.
And like Madonna's name is Madonna.
What you got on there? Right, well, I've been very much looking forward to this. Mick has written a very well-received book on Prince. I have not, but I will say that I've been listening to Prince for many, many years, especially in his Pomp, 86 to 91, 92. Would you say that was when he was at his finest creatively?
Not necessarily.
Come on,
no.
Let's have it then.
I don't think there was any one period where he was spectacularly better than any other.
What's your favourite Prince song?
I hate it when people ask me that because I don't have a favourite
right,
album or a favourite
song
group
that you like by Prince.
1999.
Oh, I love that song.
Well, that falls out of the period you were just discussing.
Very much. I think 99 was something like 1984, the album came out.
1982. 84 was Purple Rain.
Of course, right.
But I also like Wanna Be Your Lover, which was his very first single in 78, 79.
With the Off the For You album. His debut?
Is that what it was called? Oh, yeah, of course it was.
Second one was called Prince.
You know, because it's Prince, I was immediately thinking of Figure Four and a U. Oh. But it was actually F-O-R-Y-O-U.
It was called For You.
Yeah. And also, what was it? Dirty Mind. I saw him in New York around that album, and I also saw him at the Lyceum in London.
Wow.
And that was when he was coming on stage in the stockings and suspenders and the Dirty Mac. It was absolutely fabulous. And you really got the feeling that he was thoroughly enjoying himself and just having great fun. It wasn't that he was mental, which is kind of what people started to think about him later.
Yeah.
He had a great sense of humour. I met him at the Ritz in New York.
Oh, fucking hell, we're going to have fun with this. All right, listen then, Mick.
Yes.
I would like you to talk to me about
can we redefine my role in this?
My glamorous assistant? Is that a promotion?
No, it fucking isn't.
How about my terrifying overlord? Would you prefer that?
Yes.
Would that make you feel better?
Yes, please.
Right.
So if you could address me actually as your terrifying...
Lord Mick of Walshire.
Your...
Did you meet him?
Your
terrifying overlord.
Yes, Joel, you have my attention.
Did you meet Prince Rogers Nelson?
I did, more than once.
God damn it. I want to hear those stories.
I said to him, I'm sorry, I'm not talking. No. I met him for the first time at a club called The Ritz in New York in about October 1980. And
was he taller than you?
No, he wasn't. Prince was like 5'2".
Well, that's what I meant. Come on.
You know, he gets upset when I rip him a new arsehole, but he's really begging it for it now, isn't he?
Pray continue.
You
met him.
You're
what did we say?
You know what we...
Tantalising overlord.
Okay.
Gaylord.
Okay. That's it. I'm out. I'm getting my coat. I'm fucking off.
You're getting your dirty Mac.
He was 5'2" in his heels.
Yeah.
And I am, as any fool will let you know, just under 6 feet.
Yes, just under.
Yeah. About 5 inches or 6 inches under. Anyway, the Ritz in New York was kind of like held about 1,000 people. It was a bit like the Music Machine in London or the Camden Palace. Can you stop doing that when I'm talking? Because I can hear you slurping.
He has a good point.
Yeah. Thank you, Joel. Yeah, thank you. Okay. And I was there. Actually, I'd arrived there as the PR for Black Sabbath.
This was in, I want to say, 1980?
And it's like, I was going to say VIP. In no way is this a VIP. It's just the balcony at the Ritz, and over at those tables is the artist still known as Prince.
Yeah.
And so I said, Pete Makowski, the famous Pete Makowski. Hello, mate. And so we wandered over. He's like, all right, mate, I'm Pete, this is Mick. I'm from Sounds and he's Black Sabbath's PR. All right, mate. And Prince is like, yeah, I'm okay. I am kind of mystical.
Oh, was he a dick already?
I think he was genuinely like, what the fuck? Because he's sitting there with no shirt on. Underpants, stockings and suspenders, and he's pouring with sweat because he's just come off stage, and we're basically telling him he's brilliant. Nah, you're fucking great, mate. Oh, I loved it, you know.
If I'm right, he was 22 because he'd been born in 1958.
Yeah,
he was a kid. I mean,
Prince and I were almost exactly the same age,
right.
Born just weeks apart.
Yep.
Which is why we have this close connection.
You're practically twins.
Pretty much, yeah, except I was the taller one.
You were the tall one, yeah.
Yeah. So it was a non-event, if you like, because that was the week we saw Bowie in Elephant Man and we had front row seats. You know, that was the week we did all kinds of crazy stuff and Prince was a complete unknown. So we kind of felt we were doing him a bit of a favour.
That's amazing.
All right, mate. Yeah, you weren't bad. I've got to write a review.
Yeah, you're going to go a long way, my son. Clap him on the back.
6-7 months later, he comes to London for his first show at the Lyceum. Mm. And Warner's took in a sort of coterie of journalists because there was hardly anybody there from the music press. He was so ill-considered that I think there was about three of us. And we got taken back, I think because they were desperately trying to show him they were doing something with the press, you know.
Yeah.
And he was really normal, quite funny. You could
friendly,
chat.
Friendly, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
I mean, he'd at least put some trousers on at this point.
Did you say this was a few months later, so we're still in...
Literally, same tour, same album.
So 81.
Yeah. I loved Dirty Mind. You know, there was a ludicrous picture of him on the cover. And, of course, there's a whole history of ludicrous pictures of Prince now. But at the time, this is 1981. This is, you know, Spandau Ballet.
Right.
And
Duran Duran coming out.
Duran Duran, I guess, first
album was that year.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And here's this... He just looked like a weird alien from outer space.
He looked good, though.
He did, but not in a cool way. He wasn't new romantic. He wasn't punk. He wasn't heavy metal. Plus,
he'd had P-Funk and a bit of sort of, you know, no, Sly Stone. He kind of had some of that.
Those things weren't in the music papers in those days.
Yeah.
We're talking about Joy Division.
Well,
you know,
okay.
You know, this
I was
is
just thinking of a precedent.
This
the
is
way he
Ian
looked.
Curtis died for you.
Yeah.
Now, this is the real militaristic, fascistic element of the new wave and punk that I hated, you know, and that's how I ended up gravitating more to rock bands because they were the entire antithesis to that kind of really uniformed...
The rules kind of
thing. I remember sitting in Sounds editorial meetings. They would snicker at Prince and they couldn't take it seriously. I mean, A, because he was black.
Yeah, really? It was that?
Oh, well, no, listen, the whole music... How many black artists did the NME write about over the years, you know?
Right.
Stevie Wonder, Sly Stone, Jimi Hendrix, and, you know, obviously some others, but... Not every week.
Mm-hmm.
And Prince is what? No one knows what he is. Is he rock? Is he soul? Is he He's like, he's just fucking weird, isn't he? Yeah, he'll be gone. This time next year, we won't even remember. And Prince, I mean, what a shit name. I mean, it was a shit name. It really was.
Was there no love in the press for him?
None, apart from me and Sandy Robertson on Sounds. Mm. Pete Murkowski liked him, but Pete by then had left the whole music writing thing behind. I think he was living in Thailand. He really was. And someone on the NME, whose name I can't remember, but he wrote a really sarcastic, scathing review.
Not Paul Morley.
No, it wasn't an easy-to-remember name.
Okay, right.
But it was just, I think mine was the only good review.
You deserve credit for that.
Make it sound like I'm after credit. I'm not. I'm just expressing the astonishment that I now look back on those days and think how everybody missed him.
Dead rock stars. So much love. So much love.
And so, in fact, by the time you get to the 1999 album, he still is not being taken seriously in the press. Chris Salovich did a fabulous piece on him for the NME, and even that was like, who does he think he is?
Yeah, okay.
You know, they couldn't get with it. He wasn't serious enough for them.
What was it that irked them? Was it the sexual stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, the Dirty Mind album was aptly named.
Well, he had that song Sister, didn't he?
Yeah,
which is specifically about incest.
Fucking your sister, yeah.
That is bizarre, isn't it?
I mean, when did fucking your sister, you know,
when
become an issue?
When was it part of polite conversation? I mean, that is kind of... I can't really think fondly back to that kind of stuff.
Oh, shut up, you prude.
Well, no, I'm a bit prudish.
You never met his sister, did you?
I am quite prudish.
She was smoking.
Tyker.
She was smoking.
Smoking.
Smoking. And also, listen, all joking aside...
Oh, sister!
He was joking. He was fucking with you.
Well, not with you.
He was playing against stereotypes, and he was looking... You know, his album after Dirty Mind was called... Controversy.
I love that song.
You know, people hated Bowie when he came out and said he fucked men. You know,
how wrong.
Shocking. Yeah, I'm shocked.
You know? Offended.
I'm very offended. This guy Prince that no one's ever heard of, he's got a track on an album no one's ever heard of, and it's about having sex with his sister. Oh, I say, I never want to hear any more about him. And what's his name? Ponce? Oh, no, Prince.
Yeah. It's terrible, isn't it?
So it smacks of small-minded
Britishness.
Bullshit.
England
was
like that.
Still is, some might say. But here's the point. The real point is he's a super talent. And, yeah, they're finding it hard to pigeonhole him because he is hard to pigeonhole.
Yeah.
He's rock. He's funk. He's soul. He's black. He's
white. Was there
white.
Anyone like him before him who blended black music with white rock and was black? Was there anyone like that?
Jimi Hendrix.
Wow, yeah.
Sly Stone. Phil Lynott tried it, but it wasn't any great success. You know, the famously Whiskey in the Jar... The B-side of Whiskey in the Jar was Black Boys on the Corner.
Yeah.
Which, da-na-na-na-na-na, da-na-na-na-na-na. And they flipped it. The record company flipped it. That was going to be the A-side. That was his next big musical statement.
Yeah.
And the B-side was just a throwaway version of Whiskey in the Jar. And they flipped it, and it fucked him up, except Whiskey was a hit.
Fleetwood
Mac. Never played it live. Never played it live. So, yes, there'd been lots of precedents before Prince. Jeff Beck played with Stevie Wonder.
Little Stevie Wonder.
In fact, Superstition was written for
tune.
Jeff Beck.
What a tune.
Well, that was written for Jeff Beck, and then Stevie Wonder said, no, this is too good. Sorry, Jeff.
I'm having it. So fuck yourself, Jeff. Prince, who was signed to Warner's at the age of 17, which says quite a lot, and then his second album, Prince, I don't think For You was a massive success. It was the second one, Prince, that was a big hit. He produced, he played the instruments, he even clicked the camera shutter for the cover shot because they jokingly said to him, why don't you take the fucking cover picture down? And he did.
There is more background to that. He was mentored in the studio for a long time.
Larry Graham.
Yeah, Larry Graham.
Right, because he was a collaborator with Larry for years in the later part of
in
his
the
career.
Later part of
they
his
had
career.
That whole weird Jehovah's Witness thing together.
But Larry, of course, was in Sly and the Family Stone.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's like, well, we've signed this guy, he's 17, he's 18, he's going to play all the instruments, write all the songs, produce it and arrange it? No, I don't fucking think so.
Oh, you don't think it was arranged by him?
Let me finish.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So they went, let's get Larry in. Mm. And, you know, get a grown-up in the room. and after a few weeks, Larry said, kid's genius,
yeah, right.
Doesn't need me. And they went, oh, okay. And from that came I Want to Be Your Lover, and that was his first big hit. On the album, it's like 6 minutes long, and the single, of course, is like 3 minutes long.
Yeah.
It's a perfect pop soul record.
They talk about the Minneapolis funk sound, as you well know. And as I understand it from reading interviews with the various producers that, or Prince produced his own stuff, but people who were with him, what you had was a well-established funk and soul heritage in Minneapolis. But what Prince did was replace the horns with keyboard stabs, right? So when you've got... right? That's a keyboard replacing the horns. And that was very much Prince's sound. That was his sound. And that was his innovation, so I hear. And that was what grabbed people's imaginations. People loved it. Synth stabs were very much the order of the day, right, in the early to mid-80s.
Mm.
And when you allied that to his sort of grasp of a rock riff, there you go. There was Prince's modus operandi.
I'm not doubting your word.
Yeah.
I'm just not personally aware of any great funk tradition in Minneapolis.
Well, it had a black community which made black music, so that's what I mean.
Mm.
I'm not saying there's a whole list of chart
toppers
from that.
Because Prince was really fond of FM rock radio.
Yeah.
His influences were really across the board. I mean, hence the obsession with playing great rock guitar. There's a phrase these days, white famous, which means you're a black artist, but your fame transcends just having a black audience. It goes to a much broader mainstream audience, a white audience, and that's when you become white famous. That's a thing now. And Prince always wanted to be white famous. His big break was, it was a disaster, but it was meant to be one of his big breakthrough shows, was opening for the Rolling Stones at the LA Coliseum.
When was that then?
This is like 81.
Oh, really?
I think
early
probably on, the
yeah.
Tattoo U tour.
Yeah.
And two nights, and it was an unmitigated disaster.
Huh.
This was just on the arse end of the Disco Sucks era.
Yeah.
And the 99% white audience in so-called liberal California booed him off the stage.
Wow.
And they actually had to close the set after about three or four songs.
God.
He walked off in tears. It's the LA Coliseum, 70,000 people.
Yeah, right.
And refuses to come back. And Jagger personally begged him to come and do the second show because he said he would never put himself through that again. So he came and did the second show. It looked like it was going to go the same way, but he toughed it out and he got the band to literally just jam like fuck and played the arse off the guitar and kind of won a lot of the audience over. I don't think any of that audience were running out buying his records the next day, but he didn't get booed off and he walked off to some sort of applause.
It's a mad story.
It is a mad story, but, you know, that's Prince. And
yeah.
And also, when you talk about the banks of keyboards, you're absolutely right. That's a brilliant call you've made there.
Well, it's not my original observation, but...
Well, you hear that most, for the first time, most effectively on the track 1999.
Yeah.
Now, in the early 80s, particularly in Britain, but also America to a great extent, you mainly found out about artists that weren't on the pop charts through the music press.
Mm.
And no one found out about Prince through the music press. They found out about it through 1999 and that spectacular video he did. And I can remember me and my friends looking out for it on was Channel 4 even going? I can't remember. Yeah, I think it was by then. The Tube or some of those weird... Rick Wakeman had a show called Gas Tank. You probably don't remember that, do you?
I never even heard of it.
Gas Tank. You must Google that. Rick Wakeman... Gas Tank. It was like 1982 and it made the old grey whistle test look like, you know...
Right. Anarchy or whatever.
Look like a space launch.
Right,
But we remember seeing it and it was just amazing because it was spectacularly exciting and very sexy. And this is where I think he borrowed a lot from Sly and the Family Stone, because you've got black guys, black girls, white girls, and the music is similarly... configured, you know, in a multi colourful strand way. That video, you get the two girls on keyboards, both dressed in their lingerie.
Was that Wendy and Lisa at this point? Or was that...
I think one of them was Lisa, but the other one was just hot blonde babe.
Yeah.
They're pretty much dancing, well, swaying. They're swaying together. It's like...
Mixed swaying at this point.
With someone like to, you know... So exciting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, this was very much a dummy run for Purple Rain. So he had it figured out. He absolutely knew where he was going and what he wanted to do. Mm. And yes, he cherry-picked the best of the local musicians. But at the same time, he was also forming associate groups. You know, he was working with artists on their albums. He was writing songs for dozens
so the
of
time,
other people.
The Time was the
was
early
one
band
of them.
He'd been Morris Day was the leader of that band, and he'd worked alongside
yeah.
them, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
no, no, no. Prince put them together.
Okay.
Now, these are all dreams Prince had.
Apollonia.
Yeah, that was
Vanity Six.
Yeah, he shagged all of them.
I'm sure he did.
And made great records with them.
Yeah.
But he also wrote hits for, people don't know this, he wrote hits for Stevie Nicks. He wrote
Sheena Easton.
Sheena Easton famously, who he also shagged.
Did he?
Of course he did.
This is like
Prince.
Being at school. This is not being at school. Did you know he shagged her? He did.
Of course he did. I mean, Prince shagged more people that he worked with than almost anybody else I can think of.
It's amazing, isn't it?
But also Chaka Khan.
Chaka Khan?
That one. I Feel For You, or whatever it is.
Of course. It is called I Feel For You.
That's Prince.
That was
Prince
by
wrote
Prince.
That, produced it. He used to do a lot of these things with pseudonyms.
He wrote Manic Monday.
He wrote for
Get
the Bangles,
the fuck
yeah.
away. All right,
who
so
he also,
wrote...
Who he also shagged.
Did he?
Oh, of course he did. Very and, of course, very famously, Sinead O'Connor, which he didn't produce, but did write for another group, not his own.
So the point is made, he not only had his own career, he managed and made a great success of many other bands' careers.
Can I just say about Sinead
you
O'Connor?
You may, yes.
He had nothing to do with that record.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She
am
just
I telling
covered
you,
it.
Am I telling you things you know?
Well, she just covered it, didn't she?
She didn't just cover it.
And her
it.
Version was better.
She reinvented it. His version is nothing compared to Sinead's.
Mm.
I'd like to say that again. Prince's version is nothing. I think when he saw the video, he rang Sinead.
Yeah.
He said, "My version is nothing compared to you.
To yours.
To you. No, to you."
Yeah, right.
And invited her to his mansion, Paisley Park. I think because he was thinking of a bit of, you know, collaboration. And she famously wasn't having any of it.
Mm-mm.
And he told her off for being, I think, of all things permissive or, you know, not being respectful. And she apparently punched him right in the chops and stormed off.
Fucking brilliant.
Yeah, right on Sinead.
She's great, that woman.
She punched Prince
she punched
in his
Prince.
Purple puss.
It sounds like he fucking deserved it.
Of course he fucking deserved it. Fuck that guy!
Dead rock stars lobbing light grenades into the gloom.
We're talking about a man of incredible voluminous talents. I don't know if voluminous is the word that applies. I'm saying it, though.
I've read your stuff.
Yeah?
That's you what I'm
get,
saying.
You managed to get through it.
In
now,
voluminous
look, are we detail. Right? Are we right in saying that he exploded onto the worldwide scene with Purple Rain? That was when it all...
I think that was when he burst onto the scene.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's when he exploded...
Did the film come at the same time as the album, or was it a bit later, or what was the score?
1984. Now, I remember this very, very well, because I was a champion of that record and that movie. Crusher Jewell,
yeah.
who was the designer on Kerrang!
And
magazine.
Legend, rock legend.
Well, legend to be. He wasn't in 1984. In 1984, he was still Steve Jewell, and he wore these glasses that looked like your grandmother's, and it was... me that dragged him out of his shell and started calling him Crusher. He did have that as a nickname, but no one ever used it because, honestly, this was like visiting your auntie when you saw it, Steve or Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
It was later that he then developed this wonderful persona, but it was already there, the craziness. And the Kerrang office was in Covent Garden. Of course, no social media, no video even.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to see the movie, you went to the movie theatre. And it was showing in Leicester Square, and it was on for about a month. And Crusher and I went to see it 9 times.
Oh, wow.
3 of those times, tripping heavily.
Really?
Yeah.
Like falling over things?
Well, the 3rd time... Crusher was evicted from the theatre because he was literally running around the whole thing. He was having a freak out, running around going, rock, 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 yeah, yeah. And I'm going, cool it, man, cool it, man.
Dude, calm down, are you English?
The pigs.
And making a scene.
So literally these ushers, these like old lady ushers are running after him with torches. On the
Sit
screen
down, young
on the
man.
Screen it's, you know, when doves cry, dim, 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 yeah, yeah, and all these torches following him. Finally they get him, tackle him to the ground, and don't forget he's tripping on heavy duty mescaline.
He's quite tall, isn't he? He's a big lad. Isn't he? He's quite tall. I've met him. Maybe he's grown since those days. Come on, continue with the story.
Are you sure you weren't tripping?
Come on. So they wrestled him to the ground and that was the end of it.
Threw him out. So I'm left there on my own, tripping out of my brain, thinking...
Sure, that's not legal.
Surely there's some way out of here.
There must be some kind of way out of here.
Yeah, and there wasn't. I stayed till the end, found my way to the tube somehow. But that's another story. The point is we became obsessed with the movie and the album, and it was all simultaneous because When Doves Cry was the first single, and the video for
Of course,
When Doves
it has bits of the film in it.
All of the film is in it. You know, it's like a trailer for the movie. The bit on the bike and all that stuff, that's all in the movie.
Can I tell you my favourite scene?
Is it the bit where she...
Yes. First, you have to purify yourself in the waters of Lake Minnetonka. And she does, first removing her top. Now, I was 13 or something when this
film came
out. Wasn't
it all her clothes? I thought it was all her clothes.
No, she retains the bottom dignity.
Does she? I don't think she retains much dignity.
Me and my friend Phil, I'll give my friend Phil a big name check here, who introduced me to Prince and was a huge, huge Prince fan. He had it on video. And we would incessantly watch that scene in our feverish little teenage way.
She was a big-boned girl.
Insanely beautiful, that woman. And, that was my moment. I tell you, I was very confused and happy about that for many years to come.
Well, I ended up having the movie on video and watched it about another 100 times. Mm. And I have to say,
pause button, bro.
She was in many of my favourite scenes. But yeah. Mainly, you know why?
Do tell.
Good singer.
Oh, she's a great singer.
Yeah. But that was a great movie. And don't forget, he wrote that.
It's unexpectedly a great movie. Surely the odds would be stacked against it.
Oh, it should have been absolutely.
And yeah, it was great.
Shit.
He got an Oscar for it, didn't he?
Yeah.
As well as the associated Grammys and stuff. But that film was... So outrageous, so brilliant, so not really that true, I don't think.
Yeah, but when has truth had anything
when's
to do with...
When's it ever interfered with a good film, right?
You see, the thing is, there's truth, and then there's ultimate truth.
Man, that's deep.
Well, you can watch The Simpsons and go, well, it's just a cartoon. No, mate, there's a lot of truth going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Why I think that movie was so ultimately brilliant was because, of course, it was ridiculous and over the top and hilarious... But that time when you see him on stage, he's got no shirt on. He's got a blindfold.
Oh, yeah.
And he's singing and that to me is truth because that ain't an MTV video. That's actually him on stage doing something he would do on stage. He's also, you want to look for deeper levels, he's also referencing Jimi Hendrix's performance at Woodstock where he had a guitarist on stage. A black guitarist on stage, completely blindfolded. Especially if you're tripping, you know, you can find a lot of significance in that movie. There's truth in there.
I like it, man.
Truth.
And there's that whole thing with him and Morris Day, and what was the club called? Fifth Avenue. I always wanted to go there and see the beautiful people who were rather different from rural Somerset, where I was growing up, surrounded by pig farmers and their offspring. The album Purple Rain, the album starts with Let's Go Crazy, which has that all-time great intro.
Dearly beloved.
Dearly beloved. Get through this thing called life. Electric word. Life means forever. It's my long time. And at the end of that song, he does that insane Eddie Van Halen style solo.
I don't remember that.
Go straight into.
Are you sure you weren't tripping?
Go straight into Darling Nikki, as I recall.
Yeah.
Another amazing song which had a very rude
word
in it.
About masturbation.
It did. It had. I met her in the hotel lobby.
Where she was masturbating with a magazine.
Yes.
Yeah.
And apparently that was quite shocking at the time. Enough for.
I'd say that was fairly shocking now.
Who was that?
Can you imagine if you're watching. Not that I would. You'd have to stab me in both eyes if you caught me. But if you're watching The X Factor. So what are you going to do for us, love? I'm going to do Darling Nikki by Prince. Oh, go for it. A man is the pure cold Nikki. Masturbating with a man. You can't say that.
Yeah, right.
Because I've never masturbated.
Where was I going with that? Tipper Gore.
PMRC took objection.
He was one of the filthy 15.
They mentioned that line in court. Mm. I was.
No, imagine shaking American me.
Hey, I was reading this with my daughter.
I was reading the Bible with my daughter. And
Bible study class.
She showed me. the lyric sheet from
this
album.
M word.
And I couldn't believe my eyes. I had to seek therapy from
I'm
my
shocked,
therapist.
Barbara. I'm shocked.
I mean, I just had to drop another Quaalude and have a whiskey. I mean, yes, I often masturbate with magazines, but I wouldn't put it in a song and play it to my children of God.
I wrote a long piece once about the Parents Music Resource Centre, PMRC, from that 100 years ago. And it was a big piece on censorship in music, so I went back to Elvis and so on and so on. And when I got to the 80s, it was just hilarious, this nonsensical satanic panic that had America up in arms, certain parts of America, not the more liberal parts that we know and love. And Prince, of course, you look back now, God, it's all so innocent. Yes, he wore a G-string, and yes, he used the word masturbate. Oh, my God. Were we all idiots back then, or what?
No, of course not. That's why 9 million people bought that record and why he won an Oscar for the movie.
Yeah.
People in the PMRC, they were the idiots. And, of course, you know, it's news.
Politicians.
It's a link
never
on TV
them.
Or the news channel, you know.
Tipper Gore.
Tipper Gore.
Al Gore's wife.
Yeah.
Why they didn't tell her to fuck off, I don't know.
Do you know what? People did tell her to fuck off because none of these careers ended. You know, the irony was, the sweet irony was that as soon as you got one of those stickers on your record, it was like a badge of honour.
Yeah.
It's like now, these days, I mean, I sit at home and you're watching TV and it go, the following programme contains scenes of
you
sex
may find
and violence.
Distressing. Yeah.
No, no, sex and I'm like, booyah!
Is it?
This is my shit! This is my people! Excellent! I only want programmes have sex and violence
from
and
the outset.
Disturbing scenes from the outset and filthy language.
From the credit.
From the outset.
In the credit.
You want that
know,
shit. You
it's
want
just
that
bollocks,
shit.
Isn't it? This was the era of Mike Reed refusing to play Relax by Frankie as well. I hated all. Even when I was 12 years old, I knew this was all bullshit.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
Sign of the Times, there was an accompanying VHS release called the Sign of the Times tour.
I tell you where he did fail was that there were never any movies after Purple
Rain.
Oh,
he did Graffiti Bridge, that was bollocks.
And he did Under a Cherry Moon, that was also bollocks. Purple Rain was a complete one-off. You could say that the fact that it was given no chance, done on a shoestring budget, kind of worked. Whereas after that, he was given millions to make movies, and of course,
there's a lesson
I mean,
there
Cherry
for us.
Moon, wasn't that in black and white as well? And
might have been. Yeah. I watched half of it and switched off.
Do you know what? I didn't watch any of it. And I'd been to see Purple Rain 9 times while tripping and had the video, like, worn out at home. I just wasn't tempted to see any of the things that came later because they tell they reeked of bollocks.
Damn straight. So what I will say, though, is that this live video of The Sign of the Times was amazing, right? I don't know where it was shot. I can't remember. Someone will know. You can Google it. It was the full 2-hour concert. They were all there. Sheila E. was on spectacular form. He had a full-on car on stage.
Well, yeah.
He had a basketball hoop and he was chucking basketballs through it.
Well, he was a basketball player as a kid.
Right.
You know, one of the reasons he became good at basketball was because he was very, very short and would have the mickey taken out of him at school.
Right, right.
So he grew an afro particularly high to make himself appear somewhat taller.
Right.
And then in basketball, where he was clearly expected not to do well because he was so short, he was mental. He was like Speedy Gonzales. He'd be up and down the court.
Ay.
Going, ay.
The high heels that he wore his entire life, I always thought were a bit tragic, but there you go.
Listen, nobody's perfect.
Well, no, there is that. I have a funny story about that, actually. I interviewed one of his drummers from much later on in the 2000s, and for the purposes of Prince's creativity, his band were resident in the studio, right, in Paisley Park.
Oh, right, of course, yeah.
And they would be sleeping downstairs in the studio where Prince's bedroom was upstairs. And they knew to get the fuck up and ready to play when they heard this on the ceiling above them. Because what had happened was that Prince had climbed out of bed, put on his high heels, and was going across the floor.
Do you know when the...
You could have just put some trainers on everyone else, you know.
You mentioned the Sign of the Times tour.
Oh, yeah, great.
I knew one of the wardrobe ladies on that tour, because she did Def Leppard and all kinds of
people.
When
you say you knew her?
No, literally just, you know, because in those days I was always on a different tour and you got to know caterers and wardrobe people because they would all turn up. And it didn't matter which band you were with, as long as you knew those people, you knew you'd be looked after.
Did you say looked after?
She had these pair of glasses because he'd started wearing glasses.
Yeah.
And she'd nicked them from his dressing room because he had like dozens.
Yeah.
And of course they weren't glasses, they were pure...
Straight through.
They just like glass, he just liked the affectation. And she said, what's bizarre is that on that whole tour, this is where he's doing, like, you know, stadiums and Wembley.
Yeah, yeah.
And she said, backstage, vast backstage areas, there would be arrows on the floor. This is something that Guns N' Roses did a few years later. But this is like 89 with Prince. And there'd be arrows on the floor. And the rule was, you know, from his dressing room to the production office or the stage or whatever, as you're going in and out to do your stuff, you had to bow your head and focus on the arrows.
Wow.
You weren't allowed to look left or right. And if he should be walking towards you in the corridor or room, if you said anything to him, you would be fired. You weren't allowed to say anything.
See, that makes him sound like a wanker.
I don't know. I think it makes him sound like a dude.
Do you know, I wrote...
If you're a rock star and you can't do that...
No.
You know, what's the point
no
of being a rock star?
For that.
But you like Cannibal Corpse.
Are you familiar with the band Thunder?
No, who are they?
I wrote a book about them a few years ago, as you know, because you're part of it. And Harry James, the drummer, told me that they happened to be in the studio in LA. I'm sure you know the story. And they were told that Prince was in the building and under no circumstances could they look at him.
Exactly.
Harry, being the sterling geezer that he is, wasn't going to take any of that nonsense. And when Prince walked past, surrounded by these massive security guards, looked him right in the eye and said, hello, mate, how you doing?
And what happened?
Well, Prince was sort of taken aback and murmured something and kept walking while these two giant apes who were looking after him just sort of looked daggers. But that was it. But the point is that Harry just was not going to take that, and I love that about him.
Listen, I know what you mean about wanker, but that would be for 99.9% of the population.
Mm.
If you're Prince or you're Elvis or you're Axl Rose or whoever... I want them to be like that.
I know, but would you have bowed your head in deference then? Would you have obeyed that edict? I suggest you would not have done, because you're your own man. You wouldn't have done that.
Do you know what? I can't imagine me working in wardrobe on a tour or anything like that. Whenever I was in those situations, I was always my own man. My job was not to follow rules, but to test them if I could.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I ended up getting in trouble so often. But Axl Rose was entirely the same. You know, you weren't allowed to speak to him when he walked down the corridors. I remember being in Germany with the Scorpions, OK? I'm saying Germany, Spain, in Madrid.
Well, that's similar.
It's a theatre, OK? It's not Wembley Stadium. There are no arrows taped to the floor. It's like Hammersmith Apollo, you know?
Mm.
And so we're all out in the corridor. I was with Joan Jett. She was the support act. So she's done her thing.
Mm.
So we're all having drinks and chat and da-da-da-da-da. And now it's time for the Scorpions to go on stage. And literally, and this is only people working on the tour and Joan Jett and her band and people like me. So, get out of the way! Back against the wall! Back against the wall! And we all had to, we're like this. As Klaus Meine and Rudolf Schenter with their capes and God knows what.
Battle armour.
Coming down, like wrestlers, you know, coming down the corridor. And as they're coming, I'm like, all right, Klaus, you know, Yeah, yes, I'm fine. Good time tonight. Thank you. I'm going to rock you tonight.
Mr. Voile, well, it's going well. I had the same experience. I was at the O2 with Metallica a few years ago, and I happened to be on the stage, but not visible, you know what I mean? As they walked off stage, having finished their set, and everyone had to move to one side to let Metallica through. It was pathetic.
Lemmy always told a great story. He'd always say, I hate those guys. You know, it's like, no one leaves this room till we find Philip's glove. Let's face it, that's one of the reasons I became so bitter and twisted in those days, is because they all had that kind of bullshit. I remember talking to Slash just a few years ago at the Classic Rock office, and he came in with this mountain of a guy as his bodyguard. And I went, hello, Slash, and he put his hand on my chest because...
Because Slash didn't, the idiot did.
The idiot did, because they have to justify why they're there, don't they? And Slash is like, oh, no, man, he's cool. I thought, well, good job I'm cool, because otherwise I would have shook his hand.
Would have beat down.
I'd have gone, hi, Slash, how are you doing? And shook his hand. Fuck that guy!
I've had this a couple of times. Sorry, we might have to edit all this crap out if we're running over time, but I was...
You're always telling Ian to edit it out.
All right, no.
This is the goal.
All right, look, I was backstage at Download 3-4 years ago, and I went up and spoke to Vinnie Paul. Lovely man, was very happy to see me, and shook hands, and this fucking security guard hove up to me and said, stand back, buddy. So I stood back, you know. And Vinnie was perfectly nice. It was this tool who was looking after him. And then another time, I was... You know, I told you earlier about the British Standard Time concert with Sabbath at Hyde Park. Me and a friend of mine, Jason, who sings in a band, we went as far as we could. We tried to penetrate as far as we could backstage. You know how you do a stupid game with your VIP access and AAA and all that? And we got right up to Ozzy's tent. And outside, there was this one guy standing there. And we said, all right, mate, oh, yeah, just wanted to pop in and see Ozzy. Clearly, he wasn't that stupid. And he said, listen, guys, no, I'm afraid you're going to have to walk away or I'm going to physically remove you. And I'm a big guy, and my friend Jason's a nutter. So we were laughing about this. There's literally no way this idiot was going to physically remove us. But we're not idiots, so off we went. So you do get this heavy-handedness with the security idiots that are assigned
everywhere.
And it doesn't matter if the rock star themselves is a cool guy. They'll employ an idiot.
Iron Maiden, I work with them solidly
in
the mid-'80s to mid-'90s, late-'90s. Every one of their road crew knew me of old. And at a show in LA in 88, I was stood at the side of the stage. You'd get all kinds of different things. I had a laminate and you'd have a little red spot.
There'd be different gradations of access.
Well, I had all the red spots that meant I could go anywhere.
Yeah, right.
And Dickie Bell, who'd known me for years, he just suddenly came up to me and went, where'd you fucking get that? I went, Bill gave it to me. Well, he had no right to do so. And I'm thinking, well, do you know what? You're quite right to pull me up on this. Why don't I walk 6 feet over there and everything will be much better because you've forgotten who... You've got, like, dementia and you've forgotten who I am from the other 3 weeks I've been on this tour and the 5 years previous to working with this.
It's mad.
It's utter... bullshit.
Now, I'm going to steer this back to Prince because he, after the large success of Diamonds and Pearls, which spawned those big singles, would you not say, Mick, that was his last commercial peak, the Diamonds and Pearls album? Commercial peak now.
Yes,
he did have that big hit with The Most Beautiful Girl in the World, which I think was something like 95, 94 maybe.
Yeah. He did that under Symbol.
Right, was that then?
Yes.
So,
that was his first song like that.
Is this when he was referring to himself as Symbol?
Well, he didn't refer to himself as Symbol. He referred to himself as the artist formerly known as Prince. People used to say Symbol because he'd renamed himself with a symbol. And in fact, at the time, his record company sent around a bit of software for us to use, all the journalists, on our computers, because there was no symbol on the keyboard. So we could hit a keystroke and it would come up with that symbol. And then people just got fed up with that and just used to call him Symbol as a piss take.
Or Tafcap, the artist formerly known as Prince.
Yes.
So he was famously involved in a dispute with Warner's, right, was it? And he wrote Slave on his cheek and there was some massive dispute which went on for years.
Well, it wasn't so much a dispute. He was angry that he couldn't just release tons of records. And in that sense, you could say he was way ahead of his time because in these days, the whole idea of releasing an album every 2 years is ludicrous. You can put out tracks every day of the week if you want to. Prince, like Jimi Hendrix, recorded every day.
Yeah.
I mean, they reckon, when I was doing the book, somebody told me that in his vaults, they probably have enough material to release a brand new Prince album every year for the next 35 years, you know. The thing is, he'd just signed a $100 million recording contract with Warners. And everybody in the world, why should they? They don't give a shit what the details are. All they know is, so they gave you $100 million and you're now going to sue them and say you're their slave? Mm. Do you know what? Give me $100 million and I will be your slave, you know. That was at the Brit Awards. That was at the Brit Awards where Dave, the guitarist in Blur...
Drummer.
Oh, was he the drummer? Oh, sorry. Got up and he had written Dave on his face.
As a Prince take.
Prince had got up just a little while before with slave. And, of course, that's a very evocative word because to call a black person a slave in America or to call someone a slave owner, you know, these are extremely...
sensitive.
Yeah, big buttons to push. Mm. It's like right now with the NFL and this whole controversy about taking
a knee.
You know, they're talking about the NFL owners as being modern-day slave owners. So it's a big fuse to light.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so there was a lot of criticism for him from the black community as well. You know, they kind of said, look, you can't keep doing this. Mm. Because at this point, you're talking about a guy, hubris.
Yeah.
You're talking about a man on the precipice.
Right.
You're talking about a guy who now absolutely loses all credibility with the media and with the public. And in fact, the most beautiful girl in the world, although it was a huge hit for him.
Yeah.
It was the last hit he ever had.
Right.
And in fact, once he finally gets released from his contract with Warners and he's able to put out as many records as he like and do whatever he, you know, all those things he'd wanted to do, did immediately do that. Of course, none of them were hits, even though he did actually then use Warners to distribute a lot of these things. None of them were hits. They didn't have the marketing and promotion. And, of course, what Warners has said was true, was that if you put out 3-4 albums a year, people lose track.
Yeah. The narrative... consumer fatigue.
Yeah, the whole marketing narrative becomes... you distill the offer, as they say in marketing terms. And But at that point, he does still, I think, innovate because suddenly, in the early 2000s, you get him putting out a free album with
Daily Mail.
Mail on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And the Mail on Sunday is the biggest selling, or after the News of the World, was the biggest selling sort of semi-broadsheet tabloid in the country. Suddenly, 1.5 million homes have a new Prince album.
Yeah.
And off the back of that, he does a shitload of nights at Wembley Arena.
And previous to that, had he not been one of the first sort of person to do an internet release? Or an internet distribution.
Yeah,
some
I think
kind.
That's true, yeah.
So
yeah.
He had some innovation in his head or on his site.
Always. Yeah. And, of course, for me, his final sort of crowning achievement was the Super Bowl, which, if you look at that on YouTube, it's an incredible performance from a guy who is now over 50.
When was it, mate?
2007, I think.
And what was the song?
It was a Super Bowl performance. So there was more than one song.
Right,
it was
right.
A halftime show.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got the full band, the female dancers, and it is pissing with rain. It's torrential rain. They warned him of the dangers of electrocution. Mm. They were terrified that there were these two twin blonde dancers high heels are doing acrobatic dance moves. They were like, they're going to slip and break their legs. You're going to slip and break your leg. And he went, don't care, let's do it. The whole stage lit up in purple. The sky lit up in purple. And it's now kind of legendarily probably the most spectacular. I think he was 49, nearly 49 when that happened.
Mm.
And so he had this... he kind of bridged the era into the classic rock era in a sense that it was no longer about have you got his new album. It was have you seen the show? Have you seen the video?
Got it.
The only misstep he made was when he tried to incorporate rap and hip hop.
Wow, that's not the only misstep.
For me, that was the only misstep.
Yeah, okay. I mean, he released a ton of albums in the 90s and the 2000s and going on to the other decade. But to me, and I didn't hear them all, so I'm not an expert, but they just seemed to be undefined jams. They weren't necessarily dead sharp, pin sharp focused songs that he'd done so well.
Ah.
That's my view. I think he lost his hit writing ability. After Most Beautiful Girl.
I don't know if I'd agree.
All right, no, that's fine. Mm. All right, good. The last album he released, well, he released two albums on the same day, I believe, in 2015. One of them was called Plectrum Electrum. The other one was called something else.
I'd lost the plot by then.
Well, hadn't we all? And his backing band was three girls called Third Eye Girl. I believe the guitarist and the drummer were American, and the bass player, Ida Nielsen, is Danish. And his manager picked her up from a YouTube video. They made incredible, funky, cool stuff. Insane musicians, looked amazing, of course. And they put these two albums out, which were good, had some sort of late acclaim in his life. And then in 2016, we were all shocked incredibly by the news, right? April 2016? You recall what you were doing?
No. Of course not. Look, I don't know what I did last night.
His body was found at the bottom of a lift at Paisley Park.
No, well, that was what he was doing. I recall that. No, I mean, I was shocked because Prince, you know, one of the well-known things about Prince was that he didn't drink, he didn't take drugs, he fired band members for doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, of course, he was this incredible dancer.
Yeah.
I mean, he really was an amazingly talented man. And he didn't appear to be aging very fast.
Yeah.
I couldn't understand. He died in a plane crash, a car crash. Can't be drugs.
Yeah.
But it was drugs.
Fentanyl.
Fentanyl, which is now a very popular internet drug, but was originally devised and is prescribed for people with very serious terminal cancers.
Mm.
And there's this kind of echo of Elvis in the sense that here's a guy who also doesn't believe in drugs and yet is able to have medicine cabinets full of prescription drugs.
Mm.
I think in Prince's case, unlike Elvis, I don't think he was deluded enough not to understand what he was doing.
Mm.
There was a dealer that came forth in the wake of his death that talked about the fact he'd been dealing this stuff to Prince for years. Years and years.
Can I tell you what I read? And that is that his habit of wearing high heels while he danced had given him hip problems.
Yeah, I heard that.
But he was unable to undergo surgery because he was a Jehovah's Witness and they only believe in bloodless medicine.
Right.
So his only choice, therefore, was to take strong painkillers.
Yeah, not fentanyl.
So I don't know whether that's true or not.
That may be true.
Yeah, yeah.
But that doesn't explain to me why you're going to overdose on fentanyl. You know, he overdosed on fentanyl because he was a junkie and he liked being high. That's why he overdosed on fentanyl. He'd overdosed 2 days before.
Ah, yes.
You know, while coming back from a show. He was doing a solo show, just him and the piano.
Mm.
You know, his days of the arenas were behind him at that moment.
Yeah.
And he overdosed on the plane. And they made an emergency stop, Mayday'd. They say the plane virtually came down nose first. It was travelling so fast to get to the ground. He was unconscious. They wheeled him into the hospital, hit him with a Narcon shot, the same one they used to give Slash, and it brought him round. They felt he should stay in for at least 48 hours observation. He wasn't having it. He got them to put him back on the plane, flew him home, and then he started taking fentanyl again. This is a junkie. This is a junkie. And, you know, Elvis, he had to take it because of the pain of his fame.
Yeah.
If Prince really had a serious problem with his hip, then take the fucking shoes off and go and get a hip operation. You know, he had all the money in the world and all the wherewithal to go and do something. Why wasn't he getting prescription drugs from a doctor? Why was he buying this stuff from drug dealers if he wasn't, you know, oh, my poor hip? I mean, we all tell each other bullshit stories. It became as a shock when we heard about Prince because we didn't know.
Yeah.
Because there'd always been this huge image of him as clean living.
Super clean, yeah, right.
When it came out that Elvis was a major junkie, that was really shocking.
Yeah.
We all just thought he was hooked on burgers and booze, but when the full extent, you know, Elvis had something like 92,000 different medications prescribed for him in the 18 months up to his death. And whatever way you cut it, that's a junkie.
Yeah.
Prince apparently had been buying fentanyl packs of double strength, mega strength stuff, and had also had ODs previously. You know, he's just come off a plane and nearly died. And 2 days later, they find him lying in an elevator because he's had tons more.
Mm.
I don't think that's got anything to do with I've got a bad hip because I'm a good dancer and wear shoes. That's I'm a junkie all over it.
How depressing.
It is depressing, but these artists don't become genius artists because they are happy, well-adjusted people. Mm. He came from a broken home. His own mother and father threw him out because they couldn't bear living with him when he was a kid. He went to live with his grandmother. She then threw him out because she couldn't bear it. And he ended up being brought up by the parents of a friend, one of the guys that ended up playing with him.
Andre Simone.
Exactly. All these guys are fucked up.
Mm.
But that's the grit that makes the pearl. And it's a fine balance, you know? I don't think we should ever be really shocked that these guys live lives of quiet desperation very often.
Mm, mm, mm.
Because from pain comes genius.
God damn it, Mick. You've said it very, very nicely there.
Dead Rock Stars. Carpe diem, baby.
We normally, do we not, give stars out of 5 for various criteria that we apply to the subject under discussion. Now, is there any debate on your mind that that Prince deserves less than 5 stars out of 5 for star quality?
No, he was a true star.
I'm going to say one of the ultimate. The mystique, the enigma.
Yeah, completely.
His influence. Right.
I'd say massive.
Yeah, tons of musicians sound like Prince and look like Prince, frankly.
And I think are inspired by the trajectory and scope of his career. You know, it's almost a Mozart, you know, or a Hendrix. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those that you don't have to own his records or, you know, be completely an expert in what he did.
Yeah.
But at any touch point, at any entry point in his story, you know, you're going to go, wow.
Yeah.
What was that? Wow.
It's a fucking tragedy.
Yeah. I mean, when he was the symbol and he wouldn't give interviews, you know, the lady that became his second wife, Mai Tai, you know, he would appear with a complete face mask on TV. And the interviewer would have to say, well, Prince, tell me about your new album. And he would whisper in Mai Tai's ear. And then she'd go, the artist says that his new album is great.
I hate all this cock. It's silly.
But you see, you say that.
I do, though, and I mean
you
it.
You say that.
I do.
How do you take the cock out of the rock?
Out of the cockishness. I don't know, mate.
Let me ask you. Why do you hate it? Do you want them all to be sensible, perfectly? What offends you? The theatre of it.
Right, if it was me and I had 10 billion quid and 100 million albums, you know, I would still talk to people and shake their hands and say, thanks for supporting me. I wouldn't say, don't fucking talk to me.
Yeah, but that's you.
Yeah, but I think you can still be a rock star and do that.
I'm sure many are, but isn't there room for someone that isn't?
All right, Mick, I agree. Taste for excess. Now, fentanyl aside, was he an excessive man?
Yeah. Women.
Women were his thing.
I think he was completely excessive. I think he was very sensory. I think he lived his life to the max. I don't know. But he definitely lived.
Everything's purple and silver in Paisley Park, you know, that sort of thing. He's keen on his interior furnishings.
He was an extremist, definitely.
Yeah, well, that to me is, should we say 5 stars?
I would.
I don't think it does any harm. Death as a career move. You know, he wasn't 27. He'd done his best work. I think we can agree that.
Don't know, because we don't know what's in the vaults. I wouldn't dismiss that at all. I think as a career move,
yeah.
I think he'd hit a mediocre moment in his career as a creator of music. So perhaps death will immortalise him. You know, 10 years from now, we might be still hearing... We've just this year had a new John Coltrane album.
Yeah.
A lost album. You know, that just means an album they couldn't be bothered to release at the time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But Prince, like Hendrix, has just such a deep, deep cave of material. I think they may well be some big surprises still to come.
Well, I hope so. I have a feeling that it's been slightly undignified, the rush with which the record companies and the family and his executives have re-released all this stuff so soon after his death and dug into the vault.
When John Lennon died, they re-released Imagine immediately. You know, they didn't wait 2 years. You know, it's 2.5 years since Prince died.
But there's this massive reissue campaign about time.
But why not? It's 2.5 years later.
OK, my question is, would he have authorised it if he'd been alive?
Well, no.
Well, that to me matters. What would he have wanted?
I think that's such a hypothetical question. You know, fact is he's dead, so are we going to go, yeah, but we have to pretend he's still alive and do what he would have wanted? No one knows what he would have wanted other than this stuff was sitting in the vault for donkey's years. How can we know? Oh, he wouldn't have wanted that.
No, okay, Mick.
Prince wouldn't have wanted posthumous immortality. I think he would.
Mick, as always, you explain it very well. Now, look, how do we get from Prince, Mick, to our next dead rock star? Well, Prince had a song called Queen. Queen was also a big part of our next artist's life. Similarly, while Prince actually was a horny toad, our next dead rock star had to regularly deal with a little toad. And while Prince famously felt he was a slave, our next dead rock star declared that he felt free. Well, thanks, everyone. This has been another fantastic 7 Digital production. Thank you very much to my dear friend Mick Wall and our lovely producer Ian Callahan. Check in next week. Share the heck out of our podcast. We love you very much. And any final words on the great Prince, Mick?
No.
Let's go crazy. All right. Bye-bye.